Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What is normal?
I'd like to answer this question, if I may, in two ways. Firstly, in my normal voice, and then in a kind of silly, high-pitched whine.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked and you say, who is that man?
What happens when one person's normal is another person's abnormal?
Who gets to say what is normal?
Are standards of normality really culturally relative?
You're pretty normal for a wacko.
What's so good about being normal?
Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
Our guest is Charles Scott from Vanderbilt University.
What is normal?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, what is normal?
That's simple enough, Ken. What's normal is what most people do. Well, maybe that's not quite right. I guess that's a little vague. It's what most people do, or at least what typical people do. Well, maybe it's what most typical people do. It's what normal people do.
John, you're getting a little tied up in circles there, John.
Can you do better?
Well, you were off to a good start, sort of, until you got kind of caught in your own net. There seem to be two related senses or uses of normal that were kind of tripping you up. There's what we might call the statistical sense, where normal means the average, the mean, or perhaps the median, or the typical. Then there's normal in what we might call the normative sense. And by talking about normative, I mean norms is what, you know, what we have to live up to, standards, norms if you don't do it, you're wrong sense.
Well, that sounds like a good distinction, but it's still kind of confusing. I mean, there are lots of norms that it's not normal to live up to. The standard or norm for an Olympic athlete is hours of practice a day, but there's nothing normal about that. Your normal Olympic athlete, not to mention your normal philosophy professor, is not very normal at all.
Your normal philosophy professor, I admit, is weird. But I think we've got two issues here that need to be separated. One is, what's the relation between normal in the statistical sense and normal in the normative sense? We seem to slide from one to the other quite easily. If the average, that is the normal Olympic athlete, runner practices 10 hours a day, then the standard or norm for Olympic practice you can expect to be required to meet if you want to be an Olympic athlete is that, right?
And the second issue?
Well, the second issue is how norms vary from activity to activity or commitment to commitment. What's normal for a philosophy professor is not normal for an Olympic athlete in the normative sense, right? And then there's the question of whether there are universal norms and a universal sense of normality for just being a person, minimal standards that we have a right to expect people to meet.
Well, I don't suppose you just mean things like we expect people to have two arms and two legs. You probably, being a philosopher, have in mind standards of rationality and moral standards we expect people to meet.
Right, exactly. That's the kind of thing I have in mind.
Well, okay. You've made some good distinctions here. Now, with respect to the first question, it seems to me there are two ways we go from normal in the statistical sense to normal in the normative sense. The first is conventions. If I'm in England and discover that, insane as it seems, everyone drives on the left, then driving on the left is normal in the statistical sense. I'd better drive on the left, too. The statistics dictate a norm. What people usually do is, as David Lewis says, or becomes the solution to a coordination problem. What's normal becomes normative.
So what people usually do is what they ought to do, right? Is what I ought to do. Well, that's one way to get from the normal to the normative. What's the other you have in mind?
Well, okay, now this is suggested by the runner and the philosophy professor. Here we have groups of people with something like similar goals and ambitions. To win the Olympics or to do philosophy, to be respected in the philosophy profession, perhaps make a living at it. If there are common strategies and habits that successful people with such goals, that is, normal among the successful ones in the statistical sense, have used, those practices and habits will tend to become norms. Those strategies will be what people are expected to adopt and conform to if that's their ambition.
Well, you know, I think we've made a good start on the topic, what is normal. But, you know, there's still the whole issue of what's normal in the way of mental or physical health. I mean, it's not clear that either of your methods gets us from the normal to the normative there. Instead, there seem to be something like ideals of something like proper functioning or something that might tell us what a normal person is, even if people don't often live up to those norms. If someone says, for example, that normal Americans are abnormally heavy and have abnormally high blood pressure, we understand what they've meant, but we haven't really gotten at that here, I don't think.
Well, it's confusing, but luckily we've got some help. We'll be joined in a bit by our guest, Charles Scott, author of Living with Indifference.
And we want our listeners to help, too. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Jill Replogle, puts the question of normality to everyday people on the street. She files this report.
What is normal, anyway?
I'm just a regular, everyday normal guy.
What are norms? What are mores in general?
I'm just a regular, everyday normal guy.
What is normal?
As in normal people?
I work in customer service for a phone company.
What's average? Like the status quo?
Probably fits within the middle of the bell curve.
Someone who conforms to the norms of the society they're in.
Courtesy, respectful of others, and being thoughtful of others. That should be normal.
I don't know if there's really even like a such thing. Everybody's like out of their own way.
Normal is what I'm not.
And just who decides what's normal?
We all do. We all do. I mean, to some extent, laws are a codified form of what most people think is normal.
Society has a twisted vision of what is normal. People should do this and people should do that. But in reality, people should just do, honestly, like, live to be happy.
I think everybody has their own idea of what normal is. I think that's what makes people unique.
You know, like they say, different strokes for different folks.
And is normal a good thing?
No. Why?
If everything was normal, there'd be no advancement, nothing interesting.
Homeostasis.
Well, I think it's a great thing. Like a normal day. It is a day that's not having hard luck or causing problems.
Is it something we should strive for?
It's not something I wake up in the morning thinking that I'm going to try to do to be normal. I think we probably all do it implicitly. That's how social norms work, right?
I don't think any of our parents ever told us to grow up one day, you know, and like be exactly like everybody else. And I think a lot of people actually do that because they're scared of actually being themselves.
Now in health, I want to be normal.
Do you consider yourself a normal person?
I do, actually.
Do I consider? No, I don't. I do not consider myself to be normal. I like not being normal.
Are you normal?
Yeah, definitely. More so than most people.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Jill Replogle.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Charles Scott. He's a professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. He's author, most recently, of Living with Indifference. Charles, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Good to be here.
Charles, how did you get interested in issues of what's normal and what's not?
I think I first got interested in that question by wondering and beginning to think about the ways in which normal or normalizations are established. There's usually some interest involved, not always. You've shown already, I think, that in the program that there's really not much of a normal standard for the meaning of normal. It has so many different connotations.
Well, Ken and I thought it had a statistical and a normative side to it, but what's your analysis of normal, and how did we get this funny word?
Well, we got the funny word. I think it goes back to a Greek word which means well-known. And I think that's one of the positive functions of normalcy, that it's easily recognized. And then there's also the sense of something that is a rule, or that it also can mean, or used to mean, a carpenter's square, get things squared away. But the word itself, you know, if you want to refer to statistical knowledge, how does statistical knowledge gain the authority to establish something that is called a norm? I'm not clear yet on what the word norm actually normally should mean.
Yeah, well, I think that's an interesting question. I did a little bit of research about the origins of the word norm. I think in English it first had to do with verb conjugations. Some verbs, you know, it was used to distinguish regular from irregular verbs, so some verbs don't have, quote, normal conjugation, are conjugated by no normal rule or something. The phrase was in the OED or something like that. And then only in like the 1800s did it come to mean anything having to do with, say, normal health and normal minds and all that sort of stuff. So the word has a kind of varied history. But it seems to me a pretty inescapable concept, don't you think? Forget about the history of the word, but the concept plays a pretty fundamental role in distinguishing healthy from unhealthy things, from distinguishing things we approve of from things we don't approve of, for distinguishing central tendencies from outliers. I mean, it does all this interesting and important work. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree. It does a lot of important work, and I think one of the things you're pointing out is that the word has a power to divide and to distinguish things. And that's a very important power. My question has to do with regard to the authority that is attached to certain kinds of normalcies and even to the value of the idea of normal. Why is it that normal is better than abnormal? Do you have a thought about that?
Well, that's a darn good question, Charles. But you're supposed to get the answer. But look, here's a first thought. Well, in the realm of health, say, and disease, science tells us what's normal. In the realm of human behavior, morality, religion tells us what's normal. In the realm of just what's the central tendency of a distribution? Statistics tells us what's normal and distinguishes those things that cluster around the mean and those things that lie outside of the mean. There's science, there's statistics, there's morality. Those are the where notions of normality come from.
But Ken, when you think about religion and morality, I mean, what they tend to give us is ideals rather than what's normal, isn't it? I mean, it's not normal to be completely virtuous or to be a saint.
Well, that's true.
Those are ideals. But somehow with mental health, we're just supposed to be normal. I don't know.
So, Charles, you got any thought there?
I'd be cautious around the use of science, for example, if you bring it into medicine. The factor of insurance nowadays has a great deal to do with what is accepted as normal for a particular illness. There are standards that are set for if you have these, you have migraines, and if you don't have them, no matter what your headache is, it's not migraine. There are standards for alcoholism or borderline personalities. A patient has to meet those standards in order to be considered normally a normal person with migraine, normal migraines, or normal borderline personality. It gets very complicated. I don't think science helps us a whole lot in some of the applied areas, such as medicine, in establishing the meaning of norm.
Well, there seems to be a slide from normal in the statistical sense to, or not normal in the statistical sense, to being somehow unhealthy and needing help. For example, short people, people of abnormally small stature, there's nothing unhealthy about that, but now parents are kind of given therapies for their short children.
So I think we're getting into questions about, as it were, the use and abuse of the notions of normality. Because one of the things I hear beneath some of what you say, Charles, and I want to take this up in the next segment, is that some uses of normality are just sort of illegitimate impositions on the distributions of things. But we'll probe that in a bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking, what is normal? With Charles Scott from Vanderbilt University.
Are you as normal as blueberry pie? And what's normal about blueberry pie anyway? Is being as normal as blueberry pie better or worse than being as corny as Kansas in August? Do you want to be normal? Are you proud of being abnormal in some ways? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Doesn't that prove that you're abnormal? Join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
The normal, the abnormal, and the simply nuts. Plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Smart little girl with no heart, I have found me a wonderful guy. I am in a conventional...
Are you as normal as blueberry pie? Is blueberry pie normal to begin with? What exactly is normal? That's our question today. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. How do you think of normality? Is that a good thing or a bad thing or an indifferent thing? The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And last but not least, you can share your thoughts with the world via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where John Perry has already begun to weigh in.
Our guest is Charles Scott from Vanderbilt University, author of Living with Indifference.
So, Charles, I want to get into this question of the use and abuse of the concept of normality and abnormality. It's confusing. I suppose it's supposed to be a good thing about Lake Wobegon that all the kids are above average and hence abnormal. That's a good thing. But if someone says that gay people aren't normal or that girls who like to play with trucks aren't normal, that sounds like a criticism. Okay, but then I think, is that a just criticism? When is being normal a good thing? When is it a bad thing? When is the word normal used as a swear word or a word of praise? When is it wrong to do that? Tell us your thoughts about that kind of thing.
Well, I see a lot of positive values to the use and meaning of normal when we look at social coherence in groups, a larger group, smaller groups, by virtue of something that is a normal standard. It helps a great deal in communal recognition, and it provides a kind of, I should think, predictability.
Right.
But at the same time that it provides social cohesion, it's going to cause marginalization, isn't it?
Well, that's...
And,
Keep going.
Go ahead.
No, well, look, you're making two... There's two sides. There's a light side and a dark side, it seems to me you're saying, right? Human beings are like group social animals. And because we're social animals, there are these things that enforce social cohesion and social functioning. That's what one thing that norms are for. The example of, you know, we're not all going to drive on whatever side of the road we want, right? We're going to coordinate our behavior. Norms help us coordinate our behavior. And that's the light side of norms. But you're suggesting there's also a dark side. And tell me more about what you see as the dark side.
Well, marginalization is one that I mentioned. Marginalization of people. You mentioned short people. There's certainly a marginalization of dwarves in this country. I think that norms or normalcy usually carries with it some kind of authority. And the dark side frequently arises when you say, which authority? Who is the authority for this? What establishes a majority in a statistical study as in some sense having the positive value of normal and the rest of us having the negative value of abnormal? Maybe it would help to notice that a lot of times one of the most valuable things that can happen is the interruption of normal powers and practices by deviations from those norms. There's a freeing factor. It has to do, I think, with a kind of creative freedom that one needs to pay attention to. So, if you pay attention to that, then you begin to see a dark side or a highly doubtful, questionable side about normalcy.
So the light side, as Ken puts it, is, say, for language, if there wasn't a normal meaning for words, a normal way to pronounce them, then, we really couldn't have language. But the dark side is that when you look at kind of the ways humans are, sexually or in terms of height or in terms of intelligence, then for there to be a normal, there has necessarily to be some outliers, some ones that make the middle part of the bell curve the middle by being on the outside. And is that necessarily bad or unhealthy? It seems like it naturally acquires that connotation even when it shouldn't.
But see, this is really complicated, and I wouldn't want to say one thing about the outlier. I mean, because they're think of the normal distribution. Larry Summers got in real trouble for talking about you know, guys being clustering near the extreme and women clustering near the means, and that explains why there are professions that select from the extremes are more tend to over-select for men. He got in real trouble for that because people thought he was saying men are genetically superior to women. But you know what? There's two extremes in a bell curve. There's a low extreme and there's the high extreme. If men cluster near the high extreme, they also cluster near the low extreme, and that would explain why they're the ones in prisons, you know, committing crime, all that stuff. So, you know, I think it's just really complicated. Sometimes we want the guys on the extreme, the folks on the extreme, to lead, be the leading edge, right? Sometimes we want to resist the guys on the folks on the lower extreme to stop being the trailing edge, as it were, to stop dragging. So I think this is all very complicated. Charles, what do you think?
It seems complicated to me, too. I want to put it, I'd like to think of it, in terms of various kinds of power. I mentioned earlier the power to divide and distinguish, but now we're talking about a certain power that has a certain clustering. You can visualize it, a clustering effect. And the people on the lower side of the bell curve, that curve may well not have much reference at all to economic conditions or the situations which make a person seem destructively abnormal in a certain kind of society. I think it is infinitely complicated, and that the value of the word normal needs to always be held in question, even when it's a matter of mathematics or bell curve.
You're listening to philosophy. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what is normal. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? We'd love to know your thoughts. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or comments at philosophytalk.org. Or last but not least, go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And Nancy from Marin, I think, is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Nancy.
Yes, hi. I was just listening to your program, and all of a sudden I thought of a book I had read. It was called To Hell with Culture by Herbert Reed.
Okay.
Do you know of the book?
I don't, but tell us more about it.
Well, I read it a long time ago, and it just talks in regards to artists and how they think, and you know, how artists, they think from the right side of their brain, opposite what normal people think, and so that's what makes them more creative. And if they follow the culture, you know, it's this whole thing about thinking, using your other side of your brain, the creative side, which most people don't use, which then most people think. Or you become sort of abnormal in a sense.
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for the call. Charles, I think Nancy's making an important point. Look, most of us are not the most creative, not the most innovative, we kind of cluster around the means. And then every now and then, you know, some brilliant, creative, ultra person comes along and reconfigures things. And one of the great human tricks, I think, is that the rest of us get dragged along by the, quote, abnormal, by the supernormal. I think that's a good thing about human social organization. It saves the rest of us from having to be geniuses.
Well you think about her example. I mean, when the Impressionists wanted to get their art exhibited, the reigning artists in France said, no way, that's too weird. So it was abnormal, but it was a great contribution.
So what do you think? What do you think, Charles?
Well, as you were talking, and as the caller was talking, I was thinking also about the processes of individualization and ways in which people in everyday situations, growing up and later, either rebel or in some sense revolt or simply deviate from certain kinds of things that they're expected. And it doesn't take a genius to do that. I think there is a kind of creative freedom available to most people by virtue of their being in normalizing situations, but having options by which they can change themselves or, if they're lucky, change their circumstances.
So, look, I agree with you. You don't have to be a genius to be, as it were, a rebel. And I do believe there is this constant tension between authority-backed notions of normality that want to enforce a kind of conformity and, say, the youth who are growing up and want a different way of life, or the creative people outside that who are living on the edge, as it were, and that this creative tension, I think it moves people along. It moves society and culture along. And I think that's a darn good thing. I don't really know if we could have this dynamic social movement without this dialectic, as it were, of, you know, resistance to norms and reconfiguring norms. And so They play an important kind of role in the evolution of us. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but I agree with you fully. I think that that the kind of robust divergences that go on in a multicultured country like ours is one of the sources of dynamism, as well as conflict, and one of the sources of transformations. So I'm right with you on that, and I think that can work from an individual level into business or to music or all kinds of areas. But it does have to do, I think, with normal standards and options that deviate from them or that interrupt their authority.
1-800-525-9917. That's the number to call if you'd like to join this conversation. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525-9917. Or you can send us email at comments@philosophytalk.org. comments@philosophytalk.org, or go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And we've got another caller on the line, Edward in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Edward. What's your comment or question?
Hi. A couple of questions. One is, I'd like some comment on contextual factors. I think a lot of it has to do with context. What's normative? A swimsuit, for instance, is just a swimsuit, but in the context of the beach, it's normal. In the context of downtown financial center, it's not normal. A person was talking about the art scene, and that's a particular kind of context that sanctions and accepts a much broader range of ideas and behavior than you wouldn't. If you were a performance artist, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do your thing in a cowboy bar in Houston. You know, it's completely different.
Well, you might if you really wanted to break the mold.
I certainly have some comment about that. And the second is the relation between legal and normal. I think sometimes legal defines the outer limits of normality, but sometimes I think that laws are made to counter what people would do normally. And somebody thinks it's detrimental, and so they pass a law against it, and so on. So I'll let some comment on both of those if you could.
Okay, thanks for the call.
I think the point about context is very good. In other words, when you say someone is normal, or a behavior is normal, or an activity is normal, are you talking about intrinsic characteristics of the activity and the inner causes of it, or are you talking about a contextual situation? And you bring out that things like wearing a swimsuit are normal in one situation, not another. But take something like deafness. We consider that an abnormality. Parents of deaf children are, seek to have something done about it. But in a way, it's totally contextual. There have been places where deafness was pretty ubiquitous. I believe Martha's Vineyard originally was like that. And deaf people have no real problem at all as long as there's not a lot of hearing people around passing around information that they don't have access to. So in a way, it's a difference that only becomes an abnormality and something to worry about or do something about or even think about as a result not of the way the people are, but of the context they're
right.
put in.
Dwarfism is a problem. There's certain medical difficulties with dwarfism because the spines of people who suffer from dwarfisms can be kind of screwed up and cause them all kinds of pain. But let's bracket those for a second. Dwarfism is a problem in a world made for people of, quote, normal height, right, where the doorknobs are a certain height and the toilets are a certain height and the cars are a certain length. It's a problem there. But if you had to re-engineer the world, it might not be such a problem. What do you think about that, Charles?
Yeah, I think context is extremely important in making these kind of judgments. I really like the word difference and the way you just used it a moment ago with regard to normal and abnormal. There are all kinds of differences. And you point to differences, for example, an impaired hearing, and you can say that, you know, most people do not have that particular difference. But within its context, as you say, there's plenty of quote, normalcy. So it seems to me that we could emphasize differences And if you want to talk about deviations from statistical norms, do that. But that's more of a throwaway, I think.
So would you just jettison the concept of the norm of the normal and used in normative terms? So would you just jettison the idea that there's something, quote, abnormal about dwarfism or the hearing impaired or whatever? Would you just jettison all normative notions of that?
No, I wouldn't jettison, but I might well bracket them in their use for a while. There are lots of folks, particularly around racial issues and sexual issues, that have been branded abnormal, and that's a brand. And I think if you just say, look, maybe statistically it is abnormal, but I'm not going to speak that way. I'm not going to attach this word that has a much more value than any of us can control, the word normal. I just say that there are differences here. And then you can go from there and talk about how these differences work out and how to interact with them. But I do think that the word normal carries huge amount of weight that the user will not be able, in many situations, to leverage.
I mean, I take your point. I mean, I take your point. Like personally, when I remember being a little kid and some Caucasian kid saying to a bunch of other Caucasian kids when I was around and they were teasing me, saying, how would you like to be how would you like to have an abnormal color or something like that? You know, for those who don't know, I'm an African-American. And I went home and I said to my mother, do I have an abnormal color? And she said, no, you're just different from them. And so that was a big moment in my life. So I take your point, but I'm just not sure that there's no legitimate use to these notions of normality. What do you think?
I think there is legitimate use for the words. But what I'm encouraging is paying attention to the kind of value or the kind of power the word exercises in certain contexts, going back to the issue of context. I do believe that cultural communal recognition and a certain kind of cohesion do depend on established norms. I also suspect that all norms are revisable and in a certain sense are optional, even though their work can be absolutely necessary given certain contexts.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, what is normal? With Charles Scott from Vanderbilt University.
Maybe by now you just want to quit using the word normal, but society won't quit judging what's normal and what's abnormal. How do you think about such judgments? Are some of your best friends abnormal? And what about being normal in education and medicine?
More on normality and abnormality when Philosophy Talk continues. In his body and his mind, he's a well-respected man about town, doing the best things so conservatively.
We're talking about the idea of normal. What is normal anyway? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, which we assume is abnormally high. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Charles Scott, author of Living with Indifference. And we've got a caller on the line. That's Arthur from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Arthur.
Hi, Ken. How are you guys doing?
Okay, what's your comment or question?
My question is regarding our comment about normality. Basically, to me, the concept is similar to that of morality, where it's just society that defines it on what is considered normal. It depends on where you live. It depends on the person that's looking at a situation or at a thing. So pretty much it changes from time to time. Like it changes from generation to generation. Like, for example, gays back in the days were not considered normal. But these days, if you look at San Francisco or certain areas where people are open-minded, they just think it's just normal. It's just a typical thing these days. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, Charles, what do you think about this? So he's sort of, Arthur, thanks for the call. He's sort of pointing to the relativity of our notions of normality, the changeability of our notions of normality. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think they are indeed changeable. And I think we were speaking of that when we talk about context specific, and the caller used some really good examples, I think, on the way in which what is normal has changed and changed in all of our memories in very, very important ways. You've been emphasizing that there is a value to normal, and that value still holds, I think, in many different contexts. But if you attach some sense of timelessness or some kind of state power to the notion of normal, then I think you have a witch's brew. So, norms change all the time. And they change according to situations and moods and laws and other kinds of experiences. But they, even though they change, they're necessary for us to know where we are and who we are at any given time, I think.
So Charles, if we look at the university, there's one course, one discipline or part of a discipline that actually uses the word normal, or rather the word abnormal, and that's abnormal psychology. Now, abnormal psychology is mainly a study of the aberrant and the dysfunctional. We all want to hear that our children are above average, but we don't really want to hear that they're abnormal. So abnormal psychology, that suggests there's a scientific use of normal, and it's not just statistical, because so someone with psychosis, that's in abnormal psychology, but then some things like being gay used to be part of abnormal psychology and now they're not. How scientific is the abnormal in abnormal psychology?
And let me add that back to your point about if we think that they're unchanging, abnormal psychology thinks it's trying to uncover the unchanging structure of the human mind, at least the human mind has evolved up to now, and trying to distinguish the abnormal from the abnormal in non-cultural, relative, context sensitive ways. What do you think about all that?
It's hard for me to think about all that. My guess is that if somehow the field of abnormal psychology were to start nowadays, they probably would not be called abnormal psychology. I think that's probably an older and less critical use of the word. Why not just call it mental issues or mental problems? I mean, the word, as you well know, normalcy was synonymous for a long time with sane, that is to say, lacking mental disorder. It's the branding aspect that bothers me. Sure, there are forms of suffering, there are disabilities of all kinds, and I guess the disability is always connected with some kinds of abilities to accomplish certain things or to be in certain ways. But how we evaluate deviations from the way in which ordinary brains operate, it's the way we do that that strikes me as being a source of legitimate interest.
So I want to press you on this. I want to see what you're really getting at. So there is a movement among some autistics, just as there are a movement among some hearing impaired folks, to think that autism is just a different way of being that is equally legitimate, and that you could have, a society of autistics, and that it's not something people should be cured out of. Maybe the social interface that they need to function in the world needs to be different. Just as we were saying, the hearing impaired may need a different kind of a social interface to function adequately in the world with one another. But these differences are just like cultural differences, legitimate and should not be extinguished. Only, you seem to be suggesting something along that lines. Am I right in thinking you're suggesting something along that line?
Yes, something along that line. I think you are right. Legitimacy is another tough word, huh? Is it illegitimate to be autistic? I suspect not. That there are some, it depends on the level of autism, of course, but there are some people who are diagnosed as being autistic who are very, very high functioning. I think that people who have autistic characteristics, the more they know about that, the better, particularly as they deal with human relationships and feelings. But I wouldn't want to use the word legitimate at this point. These are different formations, and find out what they are, how they function, categorize as much as you want in terms of this is more and that's less. But legitimate, no, I wouldn't use that at all. And you're right, to the extent that normal establishes legitimacy, I think I'm going to step out of the crowd on that.
Okay. Hey, Dorothy from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dorothy. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I just wanted to probably complicate the situation by saying normal is kind of a tricky concept, I think, especially in a culture as diverse as ours, because, I'm African American, and my concept of normal, the first socially acceptable normality, had nothing to do with my experience or nothing to do with my race. It was all coming from outside of that experience. And so there was this norm that you learned in school, and that was reinforced in the culture and the pop culture. And then there was this norm that I knew of as my reality that was not, at least when I was a kid, represented to me or played back to me. And I think that's true of a lot of minorities, a lot of immigrant groups, is that you're going through life with like this dual sense of normality in America and also in other multi-ethnic countries like France, like Britain. And so I think it's a kind of tricky and very kind of fluid concept of normality, because even within those groups, there are things that are considered normal that, say, I don't know, middle-class white woman in Kansas might not consider normal, you know. And so within those ethnic groups, there's normality, and then, you know, experience, location, socioeconomic ranking may kick you out of that subset of normality.
Thanks for the call, Dorothy. There's a lot to respond there, Charles. What do you want to respond to in Dorothy's comments?
I think she is so right on. I think that ethnic differences, huge differences, and this split that she speaks of, for many people, of experiencing what is normal for them and what is another kind of reality or the reverse, I think that's very damaging and unnecessary. And as she says, this notion of normalcy is so complicated, and it is connected with the way in which it tends to govern the way we're recognized and what's expected of us and what we recognize and expect of ourselves. And that means it should always be a term that's held in question.
It sounds to me like you think that the use of normality is always backed by some kind of power, right? Which is possibly, I think often you seem to think, an illegitimate power. So the medicalization of difference, right, of mental differences, right? You might think, well, we've got this major medical scientific complex. They're revising the DSM to try and figure out what's the right mental illness. And they think of that as a dispassionate scientific inquiry. But you seem to think of it as an exercise of power, social power, cognitive power in some kind of illegitimate way. Am I right about that, or am I overstating your...
I think it's a little overstated. I don't think it's illegitimate necessarily in all cases. Probably in most cases it's not. It's the recognition of a certain kind of power, we can call it initially medical authority, and how that power functions as it connects with diagnoses, with treatment, and with other kinds of recognition. The power of normal to divide and to separate, I think that's a very powerful thing that the word has with it, and I think it's fine. All power is not bad, and it's a matter rather of being aware and alert to the functions of powers in normal words and in normalizing processes of recognizing, whether it's in science or medicine or on the street.
So sometimes when we talk about normal, we're thinking kind of in long-term evolutionary terms. And I'm kind of struck by the tension between what's normal for a human being in the sense of the traits that were adaptive over the millions of years during which we adapted, and what's normal in the extremely odd and abnormal, historically speaking, situation which human finds themselves now. So I think any normal human in the evolutionary sense would probably be in big trouble in normal society.
So get one last comment, Charles. Respond to anything you like. One last comment.
Well, I think that applying the word normal in evolutionary development could make sense. I just like to note that word normal probably doesn't arise out of the very process that it names or the accomplishments that are being pointed to. There's a separation there, and it'd be good to notice how that word functions when it speaks of what is normal for a human being, and particularly with regard to its physicality and development.
Okay, Charles, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an abnormally scintillating conversation. Our guest has been Charles Scott, professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, author most recently of Living with Indifference. So, John, you got any closing thought briefly here?
Well, you know, sometimes when you do philosophy and you pick out a word or concept and you focus on it, it becomes alien to you, and you wonder, how did I ever use those words all my life? When I'm confused and it's confused, and that's, of course, that's my normal way of being, is confused, but that's the way I feel about normal and normalcy right now. I'm with Warren G. Harding. We need to return to normalcy, but I'm not. I have no idea what it is.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to end this conversation, which continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. John's weighed in on our blog, and go check it out. And also on our Facebook page, our ever-growing Facebook page.
And, you know, you can also download podcasts of our program from our website. Lots of podcasts. We got lots of them up there. You know, a phantasmagoria of philosophical podcasts. For the final word, we're going to turn, as we do always in the normal course of events, to that very abnormal, in the sense of gifted, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the National Institute of Mental Health reports that over a lifetime, half of us suffer a mental disorder. This should be tempered by the ever-growing list of supposed disorders. The 1994 DSM, the official catalog of the American Psychiatric Association, listed 297, up from around 100 back in 1974, with promise of more to come. On the horizon, maybe, post-traumatic embitterment disorder, which affects people who just can't let go of a traumatic event. Ask your ex about that one, or maybe just issue a restraining order. What is normal anymore? Every day, Joes and Janes are drugged within an inch of their psyches, and yet snipers roam med-free. I just read about a woman who was tweeting about her experience with RU486, the so-called abortion pill. She said she wants to demystify abortion, something I never considered mystical before. The word for this sort of thing is oversharing. It's either normal or a syndrome in the next DSM. Perhaps I should look back to the presidency of Warren G. Harding. His campaign slogan was, "Return to Normalcy." Though he was mocked for having made up normalcy, it was a word. He was just the first to use it in public without wincing. What was normalcy in 1920? Well, it was the first presidential election in which women voted. That was a factor in the election. Harding was good-looking in a presidential kind of way. He and his wife, Florence, the first lady to take an active role in a campaign, took advantage of that. He was the first candidate to use the media, radio, newspapers, and newsreels. His campaign had a make-no-enemies strategy, shades of Obama, and it was called a front porch campaign because he conducted most of it from his Ohio home. He was the first to have celebrities work for his election. Al Jolson, Douglas Fairbanks, and Mary Pickford showed up for photo ops. Over the course of Harding's presidential campaign, over 600,000 people showed up at his house. He won with 60% of the vote. He was the first president to take questions from reporters and enter them into a pool to answer. As part of returning to normalcy, he released socialist Eugene Debs in prison for opposing the draft in World War I. Harding supported civil rights, or at least the Dyer Bill, which made lynching a federal offense. It was defeated in the U.S. Senate by a filibuster. Lynching, I guess, was considered normal in the Roaring Twenties, at least to the U.S. Senate. Though popular, Harding was tainted by Teapot Dome, an umbrella term for a host of scandals from the Ohio pals he'd put in office. Bribery, kickbacks, suicide. Normal stuff now. Harding was never implicated, but history has decreed that he probably should have chosen a better crop of cronies. He liked to play poker with those cronies. At those games, drinks were served, even though it was prohibition and they were technically illegal. Hypocrisy. Normal. He had at least two affairs, none of which we knew of at the time, because it wasn't normal then to pay attention to the private lives of politicians. One of his lovers published The President's Daughter, the First President's Ex-Mistress Exposé, which has since, of course, become normal. Getting back to mental disorders, though outwardly gregarious, Harding had five nervous breakdowns that we know of, which may have been a contributing factor to his death by heart attack in San Francisco 2 years into his administration. He had been on a voyage of understanding. Today we would call it spin. The Teapot Dome scandal was in full swing when he died. Some claim that he was murdered. Conspiracy theory. Normal. One of the few positive things about Harding's administration, which many believe was the worst presidency ever, he preserved the Constitution of the United States, literally. It was rotting in the files of the State Department. He had it placed in a protective glass case. So today, thanks to Warren G. Harding, the Constitution can only be destroyed from without, through, I assume, the normal channels. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.